Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, immigration reform. Will it happen this year? And the impact it could have on thousands of young people who live their lives in limbo. And will the Valley's doctor's shortage be made worse as the state moves to implement the Affordable Health Care Act? And a documentary tells the stories of migrants who went from the fields to college. But first, last week, President Obama and a group of senators proposed separate plans for comprehensive immigration reform. But what could those plans mean for young undocumented people who want to serve in the U.S. military? FM 89's Rebecca Plevin reports.
Pablo Reyes Morales' dream to serve in the United States military was stoked when he was in high school.
When I saw the slogan for the Navy and it said, "A global force for good," I was instantly interested.
But that dream shattered when Reyes Morales attempted to enlist. He says it wasn't until that moment that he learned he was undocumented and therefore unable to serve the country.
When I came out of the office of the Navy, I cried. My dad is a very proud person. I've never seen him cry, but that time he cried with me and he told me he was sorry that he had never told me before.
Reyes Morales counts himself among the ranks of the Dream Army, or young, undocumented people who are currently barred from serving in the U.S. military. Dream refers to the Federal Dream Act, which would permit certain immigrant students who grew up in the U.S. to gain a path to citizenship if they go to college or serve in the U.S. military. The bill was first introduced in Washington in 2001, but has failed to pass several times since then. Reyes Morales, now a student at West Hills College Lemoore, recently spoke with reporters in Hanford. He explained that his interest in joining the Navy is not solely motivated by his desire to become a U.S. citizen.
I'm not doing it because I want something for me, but I'm doing it because I want to give something back.
He has already obtained a temporary work permit through a federal policy called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This policy, announced by the Department of Homeland Security last summer, allows certain young, undocumented people to remain in the country and work. But it doesn't provide a path to citizenship, and recipients can't join the military.
I want to give back to a country that raised me, basically. I want to make sure that they know that even though we weren't born here, we're patriotic. We want to serve the U.S.
Cesar Vargas says that's the case for thousands of other young, undocumented people. He is the director of the Dream Action Coalition, a national organization that advocates for the right to citizenship for immigrant youth.
For many of us, it's about a commitment to the country that has given us so much.
Vargas came to the U.S. from Mexico when he was 5. Today, he is a law school graduate and is interested in becoming a military lawyer.
I live in New York City, and 9/11 for me was very personal. It was so close to me, and I actually attempted to enlist right after 9/11, but of course I couldn't because they told me that I could not because of my status.
Reyes Morales and Vargas and other members of their grassroots army are urging President Obama to sign an executive order that would update the military's enlistment policy to allow those who have qualified for deferred action to be able to join the service. They are pushing for comprehensive immigration reform as well. A solution could also come through legislation.
This really needs to be seen as a national security issue first, and an immigration issue second. And it's a national security issue because the fact is that we need more qualified applicants to apply for the military, to strengthen our armed forces.
That's Republican Congressman Mike Kaufman of Colorado. Last week, he introduced a bill that would make it possible for young people who gain a work permit under the deferred action policy, like Reyes Morales and Vargas, to enlist in the military and gain a path to citizenship.
I think the greatest expression of citizenship in a country is, in this country, is serving in the military. And I think it's great to have these young people who are not yet American citizens willing to serve. And so let's give them an opportunity to serve.
Last week, a group of senators and President Obama laid out separate plans for comprehensive immigration reform. Neither explicitly addressed whether young people who qualified for the deferred action policy could serve in the military. But the president's plan does propose that young, undocumented people who go to college or serve honorably in the armed forces for at least 2 years should be given, quote, an expedited opportunity to earn their citizenship. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
We will continue this conversation with guest Dr. Kenneth Hansen, professor at Fresno State University, teaches public administration, homeland security, and Indian studies, and has studied the whole issue of immigration for about the past 6 or 7 years. We also have Javier Vasquez, a Fresno State student and a member of Central Valley Dream Team. And after hearing that report, I want to start with you, Javier, because you are an undocumented student. And so listening to that story, what was your reaction listening to that young man's story?
Well, one thing we have to acknowledge is the fact that, you know, that these are brave students that want to serve this country. And by denying a person the dream to succeed and give back to this country, it's just unrealistic. Yeah, you're trying to live in this nation of opportunities, and then you're denied the opportunity. So it just...
And that young man, in listening to the report, he didn't know. His parents had not told him until he actually went to enlist. But in reading your story, you did know since, what, the age of 10 or 13?
Well, I came here now at the age of 13, and I knew I was undocumented. I knew I was going to face challenges. But again, that didn't stop me from, you know, finishing high school, going to a community college, and now, you know, I'm at, you know, the end path of my career at Fresno State. But again, most of the students don't know. They mostly know when they're trying to apply for the FAFSA at your senior level. Most of them know when they're trying to get a driver's license. So for them, it's really heartbreaking because they see their friends, you know, driving their cars around. They see their friends getting financial aid. And for you, as growing up with your friends or, you know, or family that may have the proper documentation, it's just really hard to accept reality, especially when you're, you know, in the ages of 17, 18, where you're trying to, you know, start your personal life.
Forward. Exactly. Well, it seems, Dr. Hansen and Javier, that both Congress and President Obama are pressing for immigration reform now, and they have both put plans for it. So what are your thoughts this time around? Because, you know, we have been talking about this issue for years and years. What is your feeling this time around, Dr. Hansen?
Well, I think they'll pass something, but they do that periodically. And my issue is that I'm not sure they're really going to solve the problem because I don't think they properly define it. You know, like in the previous segment, they quoted a congressman as saying, "This is a national security issue first." Well, no, it's not. It's a human rights issue. And this involves the lives of millions of people on both sides of the border because, you know, you also have to deal with people's families. It completely ignores the problem that we have down on the border where literally thousands of people have died trying to cross into this country away from the major points of entry. And so By perpetuating these Band-Aid type solutions, like throwing more money at Homeland Security in the hopes that it goes away, or granting people some level of amnesty, it doesn't really deal with or solve the major problem. And what's going to happen is in 20 years we're going to have to go back and do this again, which is what's been going on. I think what's really the crux of the problem is not what's being discussed. It's what's not being discussed. You know,
I mean,
things like a guest worker program, for instance, or if people don't want to become citizens, some way that they can become, you know, legitimized as permanent residents.
Well, as you mentioned, it's a very complicated issue. And right now, what we've seen and what you've talked about, yes, we talk about immigration reform, but it's what is it that we're going to end up with? Mm-hmm. And really, when you take a look at this, we've been putting it off and putting it off. And do you think if what had not been made evident during the election, we would even be – they would be discussing this?
Probably not. What does sort of baffle me a little bit is they spent so little time talking about immigration during the election and so much time talking about it now. It doesn't really seem to follow. The only thing I can really recall, you know, other than, say, in the primaries where Romney rather famously said that people should self-deport, you know, it never came up between Romney and Obama in their foreign policy debate, for instance. There was not one question on immigration, and they touched on it.
Why do we continue to go through this? Why is it, you know, both sides cannot sit down? We've dealt with this issue for years. Mm-hmm. We know it's there. And say it's something that it needs to be dealt with and go ahead and kind of take it on. What is it that keeps both parties from addressing this the way they should?
I think the root of the problem itself is partisan politics. And there are factions in both parties that are at loggerheads with one another. So not only, you know, is there conflict between Republicans and Democrats, there's conflict between Republicans. And we saw that, you know, in the 2005, 2006, 2007 when, you know, there were a lot of demonstrations and big deals made about the issues. You know, you rather famously have the Wall Street Republicans who are actually in favor of open borders because they make money versus the Main Street Republicans who tend to be poorer and older and whiter and perhaps see migrants as being competition of some kind or driving down their wages, which, you know, illegal immigration does drive down wages. On the Democratic side, you have disputes between ethnic groups. In looking over polling data over a period of about 20 years, rather consistently, African Americans are as opposed to undocumented migration as white Republicans are. And then you have the labor unions who, again, because undocumented migration or unauthorized labor, I guess more accurately, drives down wages, they don't like that either. But then you have other Democrats who see potential voters and want people to be documented and legalized and become citizens and all of that. So, you know, within the Democrats, they can't get their act together either. But they've been better about hiding their differences than the Republicans have.
And I think a lot of people really don't understand that there are differences. This is not an
Absolutely.
Issue. Many people seem to think it is a party issue, Democrat, Republican, and it is not. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people in both parties who you could look at and say they have the same feelings about immigration reform. And I see you nodding your head, Javier. But
yeah. I think this has turned into a political game for the past 25 years since Rona's immigration reform. They don't realize they're dealing with people's lives. Ever since Obama took office, massive deportations of parents separating families. And again, they still think this is a political game. And it's time to change that. Because we're dealing with people's lives. We're dealing with families. Families are being separated. And that's inhumane.
And that is one of the things, too. Under President mm-hmm. Obama's administration, they have had the highest deportation rates. But then that's what people call for. You know, part of his four-point proposal, first of all, is securing the borders. We've heard this term. I don't know how many times we've discussed it. Mm-hmm. And with the work you do in Homeland Security, is that possible?
Not really, it doesn't seem to me. I mean, for one thing, you're talking about a very long border. For another thing, they're also not addressing a lot of the other issues. I mean, they'll round people up on Friday and send them home, and then, you know, Monday morning they'll be back to work. And there's a problem there. I mean, so what? You're deporting people, but you're not really keeping them out. They're just having to come back through the obstacle course that you set up. And in the meantime, you're ignoring human trafficking. You're ignoring gun running. You're ignoring a lot of other problems that are human rights issues on the borders that need to be addressed and need to be solved.
When you say they're ignoring the other issues you talked about, we've heard, mm-hmm. you know, read about you know, how dangerous it is with the drug cartels, with the crime. Why aren't we then addressing those particular issues?
I think we see it as Mexico's problem.
Well, it's kind of spilling over. I mean, I mean, between the, you know, if you look at the border between the United States and Mexico, I mean, and I think when we talk of, and when we talk about immigration reform, we always seem to talk about, you know, our neighbors south of the border. Mm-hmm. When if we're going to talk about immigration reform and immigration, don't we have to look at immigration as a whole? Because you do have people coming from other countries as well.
Yeah, and you can't call what they're talking about comprehensive because it leaves out so much. And, you know, for the most part, our conversation deals with people coming and going from Mexico. But Asians are now the largest group of migrants to the United States, not Latinos and not people from Mexico. And that's been virtually ignored in this conversation, it seems to me.
Right.
Unless they come across the border,
but then,
which some people do.
But what you're talking about again, and you mentioned it too, how it's being politicized. We saw it especially in this year when all the talk has been about the Hispanic population and that as a voting bloc, not necessarily what should we be doing with immigration reform on a humane level and on an economic level. That's that's not part of the conversation.
Right.
What we hear is about the voting bloc.
Right. And I think that's the level of the discussion that politicians tend to have. If you remember that movie Ghostbusters back in the 80s, and Bill Murray says to the mayor of New York City, "Mr. Mayor, if you let us out of jail to round up the Ghostbusters, you'll be saving the lives of millions of registered voters." You know, that's the mentality. And it's all about how can we win the next election? And so you have 535 – it was 536, you know, if you include the president running for reelection. But now it's 535 single-minded seekers of reelection. You can't hope to get anything rational done this way. And so – a more rational process might be to have a treaty between the U.S. and Mexico dealing with border issues and dealing with guest workers and permanent residents and paths to citizenship and that sort of thing. And then Congress has to vote up or down on it. And that takes away some of the individual disincentives that members of Congress have to simply pursue their own interest rather than the interest of the country as a whole. And it also brings Mexico into the conversation.
And that is one of the things, too. We're talking about immigration reform, and we're not at this point including Mexico into the conversation.
Not at all. And Mexico rather wisely, you know, to try to avoid a backlash, has been very quiet. But they certainly have an interest in this.
And Javier?
Back in early December, President Peña Nieto from Mexico came to talk to Obama, trying to figure out you know, bilateral relations. And one of the things was discussed was the immigration reform, and that's something, you know, Mexico doesn't want to be part of. But at the same time, you know, indirectly they want to be part of. A lot of money has been sent to Mexico, you know, but all those workers are here. So, I guess at a economic level, you know, Mexico wants to be in the debate. But indirectly, they just don't want to put their hands on.
Well, it's rather difficult when you take a look at the way this country has handled or not dealt with immigration reform for years and years and years. So in the end, what are we looking at? I mean, because we have been through this before. After an election, we will have this huge debate, and it will drag on. And this time, it's against the backdrop of you know, an economic downturn and situation. And even when you look at, let's say, the latest Pew study, it even says for Hispanics, immigration reform is not the biggest issue. You know, the biggest issue for people right now really is economically. It is jobs. So how is that, you think, going to play into this whole debate?
Well, I think certainly the economic interests have a big stake in this. And so You know, the business interests, the labor interests. In the valley here, the growers, you know, who certainly need labor as well as other industries, they're going to be pleading their own case, I guess. In the end, I think you'll get something passed like the DREAM Act for younger people. You'll get more border security passed. They'll probably increase the number of visas. And there might even be something, I guess the detractors would call it amnesty, even if people are punished and say pay a fine and do something to compensate for their transgression, then you know, technically it's not amnesty, but that's what they would call it. You'll get two or three things like that done, but I don't think it'll be a comprehensive thing.
To address the real issue, we'll be right back at this.
Yeah, I think if you don't have a guest worker program – see, that's where all this started, is when the Bracero program ended in the 60s, there was nothing to replace it. And then 20 years later, they pass an amnesty law. And then they start passing border security laws in the 90s and so on and so on. And so, you know, the business interests, they get more – migration, and then the people that are opposed to it, they get more border security. But, you know, these things are operating at cross purposes.
And you're not really addressing the problem. It's just like you said, that you will send people back, but then they will come back and be able to get a job.
Right. And they've let this fester for 45 years now.
Exactly. Javier, how do you feel about being caught in the middle of all of this, you know, for yourself? As a student, you'll be graduating soon. But if something isn't done, which to me, I mean, when you look at this, this is what really makes no sense. I mean, Javier can go to college, but then he's undocumented and they say he can't work here. Or so, I mean, that makes you take a look at the way the laws are written now and the fact that they don't really make sense. You can't get a driver's license, you can't work, you can't do all this, but yet you can go to college. So what are we saying here, and what does that mean to you? What does that mean for your life?
When I go back to my point about it doesn't make sense. America investing in your life. Once you graduate college, you face life, face a situation. You can't do nothing about it. Legislators and President Obama are trying to push for something. Again, I see as a political game. Who's going to be reelected in the next 2 years? Who's going to be running for president in the next 4 years?
Do you think?
But again, they're dealing with people's lives.
Do you think, because I hear a lot of this, and I'm not Hispanic, and it sort of bothers me, but the fact that the whole conversation seems to be about we've got to get the Hispanic vote, and it seems to be when it comes to the expanded population is, no, you're talking about our lives and the fact that they understand that. You're talking about a population of people who understand that that's what's going on right now.
And there's something that's been going on in the conversation. Well, what if immigration reform passes? Well, what's after it? Well, there's a lot of social problems that can be implemented for minorities, Latinos, Asians. But again, we're talking about people's lives. They just see us as just another statistic. Oh, the Spanish are the fastest growing population in the nation. And that's strong for a politician because they'll just think about how am I going to be reelected. If I put my nose in with this whole immigration debate, I'm going to get reelected by the Latino community, Hispanic community.
The Hispanic-Latino community, if, let's say, some form of immigration reform is passed, as Dr. Hansen says, but it's not comprehensive and it doesn't include a lot of the things that would really start to solve this issue at some point, do you think the Hispanic-Latino community is going to support something like that? Or is it they just take whatever victory you can get? For instance, like with the DREAM Act, you know, that for yourself makes a difference.
That's one of the problems we've been seeing around. I remember before the Deferred Action was implemented, Marco Rubio from Florida, Senator Marco Rubio, was trying to introduce something related to the DREAM Act. And a lot of – we have a few separations with the DREAMers around the nation where – they just feel like that was it. If we get some sort of path to citizenship or some type of legal resident status, we're fine with it. But again, that's not the point. The point is that we're here, we're contributing to America, some of us are paying taxes. Why should we just, you know, stay with whatever you want to give us? I think we deserve a chance to be American. We see America as our home. Just like parents, they're working. I've been living here for 10 years, and realistically, I don't want to go back to Mexico. America is my home. America is my country, and I'm here. I'm studying. I want to work for America and serve the community I live with.
So what do you think about in this proposal? Let's say the third part of the proposal where it talks about, you know, first you have strengthened the borders, you have cracked down on companies that hire undocumented workers, then you have hold undocumented immigrants accountable before they can earn their citizenship. That means requiring workers to pay their taxes and a penalty, move back to the end of the line, learn English.
That
and
takes
pass
15 years, tests. By the way, if you have to go to the back of the line.
So that's the other thing when you say back of the line, because when we talk about immigration, we aren't just talking about immigration from Mexico. You have people from all over the world going through this whole process of trying to become citizens. So if you say, okay, go to the back of the line, that's 15 years, then really how much has changed? I mean, they're put right back in the same situation.
Right. Yeah, I would say that what's happening here, I've met a lot of people like Javier in the last few years, and they're qualified for better jobs than they end up getting when they get out of college, and it's because they're being denied opportunities. And they have the education, they have the qualifications. Well, why are they not allowed to apply for the jobs? You know, and it seems to me by forcing these folks based on ethnicity into menial jobs or a certain class of jobs, you're setting up a two-tiered society. You're setting up a class of second-class citizens, and that's a human rights violation. And that has to be addressed. You can't tell people like Javier, well, I know you got your degree and you've been here 10 years, but you got to wait 15 years. You know, can't they just put all this on the internet and get it done? You know, why is there so much bureaucratic nonsense with this?
Well, I think let me look at the other side, and they would say, okay, then as a country or as business, we're not ready for the huge influx. But then on the other hand, these folks have already been here and they're already working in some capacity.
Right. Most of them already have jobs. They had jobs often before they came here. You know, they're not all standing outside of Home Depot.
And that's another thing we need to understand, that what does it mean to be in the back of the line? I mean, 9/11 made a lot of changes in the way that we handle immigration here in this country. A lot of people were put on hold that were ready on the process, and it's as of today they're still waiting to get their papers, whether it's a visa, whether it's a resident.
What is that like? You know, having to live in that kind of limbo situation.
Well, it is hard. One, because okay, you're waiting for your papers, you get a Social Security, you get a work permit, but then you're in the limbo of getting deported. You never know when an immigration officer is going to come to your door, knock on your door, and just take you out because of, you know, whatever reasons. So it's just hard, and that's a conversation we're having with the proposed immigration frame, that it's going to take about 10, 15 years to fix your status. But again, we're going to give you Social Security, we're going to give you a work permit, and if we don't like it, we just get rid of you. Yeah, and that's the problem we're facing right now. A lot of people don't understand that if you wait at the end of the line, you just are waiting for 10, 15 years, and it's been in that. Then you get your resident card. You have to wait 5 years until you get your citizenship. So it's about a 20-year process, 20, 25-year process for you to be considered American.
And doesn't that really have an impact, because what you're talking
Absolutely.
About on not only that, but our labor force.
Right.
And part of this, as you've talked about, is that it is a way to keep wages low, and to hire. I mean, if you're sitting here with somebody who's got a college education and you know that, and you hire them in a position that they're overqualified for, but then again, you're getting a highly qualified person, you don't have to pay them anything.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the issue, too, here in the Valley is there are jobs that require college educations that are going unfilled,
exactly,
which contributes to the high unemployment rate. And it's not that there's not people that are qualified or – it's not that there's not enough people that are qualified for those jobs. There are. They're just not eligible to take those jobs.
I think there – when you hear that all the time, but I think there are a lot of people out there who would disagree with the fact that there aren't enough people there for those jobs. You have a lot of educated people right now who are out of work.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So in the end, it doesn't seem like either one of you are hopeful as far as what's going to come from this.
No, we're still waiting. Today, actually, there's a delegation of students from Central Valley Dream Team that were invited to attend a one-week training. We call it boot camp training, immigration boot camp training. So they're right now, today, actually hold the first immigration hearing. So they're there right now representing Central Valley. Another thing I want to mention is that the mayor, Ashley, what's her last name?
Swearingen,
was at the debate. I was one of the students that was present at the debate in Las Vegas. Not debate, the
When the president
announced the proposal. And then I think that's one thing we have to keep in mind as, you know, as citizens or people living here in the Central Valley, that there is some potential of, you know, representation from the Central Valley. And then the frame also talked about farm workers trying for them will be the price will be faster, just like students, just because of the demand of job, the objects it's needed here in the Valley and around the nation. So I think we should start, you know, the conversation with local officials, and then involve congressmen to push for some sort of, you know,
right, start
comprehensive
have the conversation here locally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then go as a united
that
front.
Is more inclusive.
Right.
Yeah, an issue like this too can very easily be pushed off the policy agenda. You know, in 2001, President Vicente Fox and President Bush were very close to an agreement, and then 9/11 happened, and the whole thing disappeared for 5 or 6 years until, you know, public pressure brought it back up. So, if the gun debate takes precedence over immigration, or if something else happens to distract us, you know, Congress is easily distracted by bright, shiny objects.
Yes.
So and that could easily kill this very quickly, depending on what's on the policy agenda over the next few months.
Okay.
And not just that. I think if this bipartisan, you know, I guess call it a game were to finish, at the end of the day, it's going to turn to a Democratic issue. That president will be pushing around, and nothing's going to get done. It's going to turn into
nothing. As you, what you both are talking about is getting something done in Washington, and we'll just have to wait and see. But thank you both for the conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Much-needed conversation and much-needed debate. Kenneth Hansen, Dr. Kenneth Hansen, professor at Fresno State, and Javier Vasquez, member of the Central Valley Dream Team and Fresno State student. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Once the Affordable Health Care Act is fully implemented, next year, hundreds of thousands of Californians will move from the ranks of the uninsured to insured. That's good news. The downside? Many counties already face a shortage of doctors and other health professionals. The shortage is worse in the Central Valley. Emily Bazar is a senior writer for the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting and has written a series of articles about the doctor shortage in Kern County. We will be talking to her, as well as Debbie Wood, a coordinator for school health and neighborhood support programs for the Bakersfield City School District. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
I'd like to start with you, Emily. Now, your reports looked at the number of doctors accepting Medi-Cal and really their actual numbers. And there seems to be this discrepancy between what the state is saying and what you are finding.
That's absolutely true. There's a huge discrepancy. My story is focused on Kern County, but I also looked at the statewide numbers. But for instance, and I focused on Medi-Cal. So as you know, Medi-Cal is a state's publicly funded health insurance program for low-income folks. So the state says that there are 2,023 doctors in Kern County who will accept Medi-Cal patients. But then if you actually look at the Medical Board of California and the Osteopathic Board, there are only about 1,200 doctors in Kern County who are actually licensed. So there's a discrepancy of about 800.
And that's a huge number.
Say that again?
That's a huge number.
It is very big. And if you speak with health policy experts, healthcare providers like Debbie on the ground, they see a major discrepancy. They see a major shortage in the number of doctors and providers who are willing to see these patients.
Did your findings surprise you? Did you think the numbers were going to be that wide apart?
I have to be honest, the numbers were what spurred me to look into this. I had heard anecdotally on the statewide level that there were discrepancies on the state level. For instance, let me give you the statewide number. The state says that there are 104 some thousand doctors statewide who are enrolled as providers in Medi-Cal. And I had heard from the California Medical Association, which represents doctors and others, that there is absolutely 100% no way that that could be possible because there are 107,000 doctors in the state overall. And every study nationwide has shown that not all doctors will accept Medicaid. So California's version of Medicaid is Medi-Cal. And in California, that's because the rates are very low. California is 47th out of 50 states for the amount of money it pays doctors to see patients in this program.
And matter of fact, would you say just because of the rates, the fact that in California the reimbursement rates are so low, because we've seen it really it's had a huge impact on both of our medical facilities here as well, that low reimbursement rate. You've also seen doctors who would take Medicaid patients, they don't do that anymore because of the low reimbursement rates.
That's absolutely true. I spoke with several doctors who used to take Medi-Cal and who no longer do. They told me that it actually cost them to see Medi-Cal patients because of how little they get reimbursed. If I can give you an example, I spoke with a Bakersfield pediatrician, Dr. Hasmukh Amin, who sees Medi-Cal patients, a lot of them, thousands of them. He's willing to do that. But he told me that private insurance companies will pay him between $60 and $120 for a typical office visit to see a kid with a sore throat, for example. But Medi-Cal pays between $27 to $37. That's a big spread.
Huge.
Yeah.
Because of both of us know, I mean, a doctor's visit here is an easy $80. So,
right.
Ms. Wood, Debbie Wood, how is this impacting families as far as what you see when we talk about this shortage of doctors that has been so well documented here in the Central Valley?
Oh, it impacts them hugely. Many of them can't even get into care. We're finding just recently, I was told that moms who have babies can't get in for that three-day post-newborn check even for 2 weeks because there's such a long wait to get in. And children miss days of school, parents miss work. And then the children just don't get care. The families end up going to the urgent care or the emergency room instead because they don't have a primary care doctor.
And we've all heard and read that this is way more expensive, having families and patients go to hospitals, emergency departments for, general medicine.
It is way more expensive. We're in the process of doing a study for our own county right now. The other thing is it also plugs up the emergency room with non-urgent care things like sore throats and earaches, and then people who come in with chest pain can't be seen as quickly because there's all these other people in the waiting room. So it has an impact all the way around for all of us.
What about when we talk about the low reimbursement rates for Medi-Cal? We all know about it. I mean, when I say we all, I mean, people, the doctors know, the legislators know, you know, the community knows. Is there anything that can be done to boost that?
Well, certainly that's at the state level. They need to change that reimbursement rate, and that can be done by the CMS can actually change that. It's based on whatever formula that they choose to make, and supposedly there's going to be an increase, but it's not going to be enough to make up that discrepancy. Many of my friends who are doctors will just see patients for free because it costs more to process the paperwork than it is worth rather than just seeing them for free.
And I think we, Debbie Wood, I think what we've seen here when you talked about families just going without medical care, when you look at the studies that have been done on the general health of people here in the Central Valley, you know, it's rather low.
Oh, it's incredibly low. One of the biggest areas I was just telling Emily is asthma and our poor air quality. You know, 1 in 8 children we estimate have asthma, and then they don't get treated until they end up in the urgent care or the emergency room. And those hospitalizations could be prevented if they had a provider caring for them. We have obesity, we have diabetes, we have heart disease. The list is endless just because of the lack of health literacy and the lack of access to care.
And so we look at the current situation of what we're facing now. Next year, we'll start fully implementing the Affordable Health Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And what is that going to mean?
Well, since we're already so impacted, I can't even envision how long it's going to take for someone to get in to get care or if they can even find a doctor, because some of the doctors will take a percentage of their population. They'll take so many patients into their group as Medi-Cal patients, and then when they reach that number, then now today they're not taking it. So yesterday maybe they took it and they hit number 10, and that's how many they'll take in their caseload, and then today they don't take it. So I can't even envision what it's going to be. It's just people aren't going to get care.
Well, what kind of adjustments can be made now? Because we've talked to people who talked about you're going to have other health professionals sort of step up and maybe start offering some of that primary care, like, you know, when you just come in for, you know, to have your blood pressure checked or something like that, and start having nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And there's even been talk of pharmacists taking up some of the slack, so that doctors can be free to see the more critical cases.
Well, I think that, you know, I know there's already a widespread use of nurse practitioners and physician's assistants in the Kern County anyway, in the Central Valley, just because we have a hard time attracting physicians. But I think it can go beyond that. And this is going to sound biased, but it's not biased. So many of our people who are going to be impacted by this are children, but yet California does not mandate school nurses in the schools. If we had school nurses in our high-poverty schools, because a school nurse is a RN with a bachelor's and a master's level preparation, they could do that initial screening. They could treat the whole family, whether it's monitoring blood pressure, educating people about medication and how to use it, saying, no, you don't need to go to the doctor, or yes, you do. I mean, there's so many different venues we could look at that we're just going to have to. We don't have a choice.
You know, and one of the things that we talk about a lot here is growing our own, and we have a story here of two people. They're two doctors, and they grew up here in the Central Valley. They studied, and they now practice medicine in the Valley. Now, the couple encountered the same challenges that many from rural communities face, but were successful at overcoming those obstacles. They credit a program at a local university as a major component to their success as doctors. Ezra Romero with FM 89 has their story.
For Renee and Veronica Ramirez, careers in medicine were always a dream. But with childhood spent in rural California, Dinuba, and Kerman, the couple's desire to bring aid back to their communities seemed to be just wishful thinking.
I always thought I would like to be a doctor. I didn't know if I could actually do it.
That's Veronica Ramirez. She says her family helped her develop an interest in medicine early on.
I've had like medical problems in the family. My mom has epilepsy and experienced that from very young.
Veronica's future husband, Renee, shared a similar story growing up.
He had a similar goal, and you know, we both came from families where no one has ever been a physician before, and so we were really going through this path sort of blindly until we could find, you know, good mentors to help us get through.
The two met their freshman year at Fresno State and have stuck side by side ever since. But with no financial backing from their families of modest means, Veronica and Renee worried that their hopes of a career in medicine would be out of reach. That's when the Healthy Careers Opportunity Program at Fresno State came in It helps prepare undergraduate students from disadvantaged backgrounds for careers in medicine. Both say that without the program, which is also known by its initials HCOP, they may never have become successful doctors.
Both of us came from families where we didn't have anyone to look to for guidance in, you know, pursuing medicine, and so HCOP really became that for us. We, you know, literally were in that office, I think, day in and day out, and it was through that program we learned, you know, what it takes to be a good student, a good science student, because, you know, that was something very new to us.
It wasn't always easy. Kenny Bond, a mentor to the couple and an assistant clinical professor of emergency medicine at UCSF Fresno, says they pressed on no matter what life brought them, including childbirth.
She's actually had two kids during residency. She had one at the beginning and at the end, and, you know, she barely missed a beat. She just kind of like picked right back up from work and just went right to it. And she's actually one of the chief residents now, and kind of like she's excelled during her residency. So they've both been shining stars at both the programs in pediatrics and emergency medicine.
The couple says they hope that by planting themselves in the Valley, they will be part of a regional change of mentality, one that values education and decreases the so-called brain drain of educated professionals, especially physicians in the area. In fact, Renee believes that studying in the Valley brings a competitive edge.
Fresno is kind of the hidden gem, so to say. We are an educational program that's treating a tremendous or a huge community. Oftentimes they show up with such rare conditions that most residents or even medical students only read about in textbooks, but yet we experience on a day-to-day encounter. So the training here is pretty awesome. A lot of our colleagues across the country graduate from programs where they still have only been able to do the procedures that I did as an intern, so to say, first-year resident. They're only able to do that in cadaver skills labs, or they're only able to do that in kind of simulation type of settings.
Bond says the Ramirez's are a perfect example of how high school pipeline and college mentoring programs can impact the region.
They're going to provide a lot to the Valley, not only because they're good doctors, but they're going to have an association and relationship with patients that a lot of the other doctors can't.
Today, Veronica and Renee have two children and own their own home. Renee is a resident with the University of California, San Francisco's Fresno campus, and Veronica is a pediatrician in Fresno. But as successful as the Ramirez's have been, the sprawling gap in the Valley's doctor-to-patient ratio cannot be filled by them alone. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Thank you, Ezra. And that's one of the situations, both Emily Bazaar and Debbie Wood, is that, yes, we can grow our own physicians, but this is something that's going to take a while.
That's correct. It takes about a minimum of 8 years for a physician, if they were to be in college today as a freshman, till they graduate is about approximately 8 years. So that's not going to help us a year from now.
And also, I think when you take a look at, when I listen to the story about this couple, and from when you talk to other students about medical school, you know, historically, it seems, you know, institutions have made it very, very difficult to get into medical school. It's very competitive, and it should be. But perhaps when you take a look at the doctor shortage here, we should maybe try to open up the process more? How would that work?
I think recruiting is important, but we still need to make sure that they're well-trained. I think there are some things that they can do to make it a little more streamlined and not quite so difficult to get in. But the biggest piece of it is the financing. You know, when you go to medical school, you're going to spend the rest of your life paying off your student loans and things to go to medical school versus doing some kind of publicly funded programs that will pay for medical school. I think that's a bigger answer.
But I think both of you, in the work that you do and your studies that you've done, you've both brought up issues that could help when we talk about this, and that is compensating doctors more, doing things like putting more, bringing nurses back into the schools. So maybe, hopefully, our legislature might take a look at some of these issues. We're going to have to do something as we come on to next year. Thank you very much, both of you, for your time. Emily Bazaar, senior writer for the California Healthcare Foundation, and Debbie Wood, coordinator for school health and neighborhood support programs for the Bakersfield City School District. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Camp to Campus is a documentary that tells the stories of first-generation college graduates who come from a migrant labor background. It premieres this evening in Bakersfield in the Door Theater. Here to talk to us about this film is Marit MacArthur, and she's the project director for Camp to Campus and associate professor, Department of English with California State University, Bakersfield. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, yes, it's Marit MacArthur.
Marit, okay. Marit, tell us a little bit about this documentary. Why did they choose to take a look at this particular subject?
Well, about three-quarters of the first-year students at Cal State Bakersfield tend to be first-generation college students. And so I'm always trying to think of how we can encourage them and retain them and, you know, help them feel that they really can succeed and overcome challenges that they face. And obviously one of the most dramatic stories that we have is how, with our agricultural history and our dependence on agriculture, how people make that transition from agriculture to higher education. So we were thinking of first-generation college graduates in general, but a dramatic story that we could tell that would help inspire others to complete college and also to deal realistically with a lot of the challenges that they face and think about how to get through them rather than just, you know, say, oh, yes, you can do it. What are some of the real challenges they face?
What did it take to put this together? I mean, when you wanted to go out and look at those people who today now are all adults, I had a chance to look at some of the documentary, and they have achieved things in their field. But what was the common thread that you saw as far as, I mean, it had to take a lot to get to where they are from where they started.
It really did. I mean, I would say that took some form of encouragement, and that form of encouragement varied. You know, everybody had a certain degree of self-motivation, but in some cases their families really encouraged them to, you know, take advantage of opportunities that they didn't have. And in some cases their families really discouraged them, you know, but a counselor made the difference, or an employer, or a teacher. You know, it was really somebody who set them, took them aside and said, you are college material. You can do this. You do not have to, you know, do what your parents did. And they, for that reason, they are really dramatic and very engaging stories. We initially did a survey last spring to gather potential subjects for the documentary, and we got a response of more than 50, just of all different, you know, professions and experiences and ages. And we just tried to pick the stories that were most compelling, but that also showed a range of, you know, all sorts of different fields that people went into, you know, law and teaching and nursing and business. So that's the approach we took.
What was the experience like, you know, in making this film?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you.
What was the experience like in making this film?
Well, like any film, you're dealing with tons of wonderful footage. You have to cut it down to 90 minutes.
Oh, that's hard, isn't it?
We had 15, you know, two-hour interviews each. So, plus a lot of wonderful landscape footage just from the valley and all of the farms around here where people were working. So it was, you know, heart-wrenching to try to decide what to include and what to exclude. But one great thing about the project is that with our website, we're able to put up transcripts of the interviews that are much longer. So once people see the film, if they're just interested in a particular story, they can go to the website and read more about them.
What thus far has the community reaction been like? I know you're going to, show the film, I think it is today or this evening.
Yeah.
But the people who have been able to see it already, what kind of reaction are you getting?
Everyone has found it really moving. And the reaction I get over and over is like, why haven't we done this before? We should have done this a long time ago. Because, you know, just so many people who are trying to motivate their students at whatever level to believe that they can, you know, transcend their backgrounds and pursue their dreams and really achieve them. You know, we're always looking for ways to motivate them, and people just say, this is really moving because people can relate to these people. You know, there are some very recent college graduates, you know, some people in their 50s, but when they talk about their experience, you know, growing up in the fields and the challenges they face, it's just so many people can relate to that, and it's different than, you know, having, I don't know, a Hollywood movie star say, you know, you can do it because they have achieved so much and you can't really see the process. But with these subjects, you really see the process and by which they achieved.
And I would think that's really part of the motivation here is that you can take these stories and show them to other young people who are also facing adversities and show that, you know, they can still achieve despite that.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking just recently, I was talking to some students of mine are planning to come, and they're African-American, and they could relate to it because, you know, in slavery days, their parents, you know, their great-great-grandparents were working in the fields, and that would have been a dramatic transition for them, too. So a lot of people can relate to it, and more privileged kids can realize, you know, how much support they do have and how lucky they are for that. I should mention that we have an essay and video essay contest for high school and community college students in Kern and Tulare and L.A. counties, and they can win cash prizes, or the community college students, we have five $1,000 scholarships to CSUB that we're giving away. So that's just part of our outreach to try to show the film as widely as possible and really engage young people in their viewing experience. And we're very open to arranging screenings, you know, anybody who wants to arrange a screening, we can do that for free as long as they can cover the venue.
And this, as you mentioned, the essay and the video essay contest, it's about the documentary, correct?
Yes, yeah, it's in response to the documentary. The prompts for the essays are on the website, and the deadline is April 10th.
Okay, and tell us a little bit more about the screening tonight. Again, what time, where? And
yes, it's at 7 o'clock at the Dore Theater on the CSUB campus. It's on Stockdale Highway. And there's free parking, free admission, and four or five of the people who are in the film are going to be present for a moderated discussion afterwards.
Okay, and that's great. And as you even mentioned that, you know, if they wanted to show the film here, all they would need is for somebody to reach out and it could be arranged.
Right, you know, and eventually we plan to arrange to show it at Fresno State and Sacramento State, you know, and really anywhere anybody wants to see it, where they have a particular connection with this population of migrant labor.
Okay. Dr. MacArthur with California State University Bakersfield, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You could hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.